Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up today, we talk to the British and Irish ambassadors to the Holy See, who were present in the Vatican for Pope Benedict's traditional New Year's address to the diplomatic corps. And then Veronica Scarisbrook introduces a reflection on Michelangelo's brand of sacred art in the Sistine Chapel, before ending with our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. So stay tuned. Pope Benedict has called for a ceasefire in Gaza and says our world is threatened not just by material poverty, but also moral poverty. The Pope called for major new efforts to end regional conflicts, reduce global poverty, and restore ethics to global financial systems. The Holy Father's broad-ranging remarks on the state of the world came during his annual address to the diplomatic corps at the Vatican. Among the diplomats present for the Pope's address was Britain's ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Campbell. He spoke afterwards to my colleague Charles Collins about the meeting with the Pope and how Great Britain is working with the Holy See to confront the challenges of the 21st century.
This is, of course, one of the major speeches of the year given by Pope Benedict. He covers many issues, talking about the different regions of the world. But one thing that's affecting all the regions of the world is the ongoing financial crisis. This is affecting both the developing world and the developed world. In the United Kingdom, we've seen layoffs. We've seen some major companies going to receivership. What is the British government doing to tackle the government first at home?
Well, in terms of the economy, that is, you are right to point out this is an international crisis. And indeed, the British Prime Minister has, I think, shown tremendous leadership internationally and also in Europe in tackling the economic crisis, both at home and abroad, in relation to assistance to banks and to the financial sector, in trying to unlock capital to small businesses and to individuals. And these are a set of circumstances that I think nobody could see coming. One of the focuses that we have here is on international development, and the Pope yesterday specifically referred to the conference just before Christmas in Doha, which is part of the Monterrey follow-up. And one of our concerns here is that the international financial crisis should not be used as an excuse for states in the developed world to fall back on their commitments to the developing world. That this is where the Pope's sense of this global solidarity and a need for a global solidarity comes to the fore. And for us, it is very important, especially in this year that Italy has taken on the presidency of the G8 since January the 1st, that really there is a realization of what the Pope said on the 1st of January in his message for World Day of Peace, that fighting poverty, making peace, making that connection, that the economic crisis, we cannot rescind on the commitments we have given to the developing world. We must continue to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. 2015 is the target date. Also, 2015 is the target date for states to be spending 0.7% of their GDP on international development. And you will hear from the United Kingdom, and we sincerely hope in continued partnership with the Holy See, the moral dimension of international development.
Going back to the economic crisis, especially when it started beginning, when banks began failing, when some of these development banks began to realize they had no more money, there was a lot of talk about the actions taken by the people in charge of these institutions. There was a lot of talk about greed. How much of this economic crisis is due to moral problems, to ethical issues? Is this something that just happens every 70 years, or is this something where people made bad decisions for bad reasons?
I think what the Pope has talked about in his message for World Day of Peace, he's talked about the positive aspects of globalization, but also some of the weaknesses that globalization has thrown up in the lack of a global consciousness. And Gordon Brown certainly has talked in similar terms about the need for new ethical or moral frameworks in relation to the functioning of the financial markets. And in terms of there is a national consciousness and sometimes there is a regional consciousness, but the economy is operating on a global level, but not always is there a feeling of a global society. And I think that somewhere in there is a need for a renewed look at an ethical framework in relation to the functioning of globalization.
Changing tack now, the Holy Father spent a good portion of his speech talking about the current crisis in Gaza. There have been calls from across the world for a ceasefire. What is the United Kingdom doing to try to stop this current conflict?
Well, we're now sitting at 17 minutes past nine on Friday, the 9th of January, and a few hours ago in New York, the United Kingdom led efforts in the Security Council in the adoption of a new resolution on this. And that resolution has really four components. One calls for an immediate ceasefire. The second talks about the humanitarian needs in Gaza and of the Palestinian people. The third talks about the need, really, to tackle the illegal trafficking of arms across the border into Gaza. And then the fourth element, which is the overall framework, which we cannot forget here, is the wider Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, getting that back on track, leading to, you know, a two-state solution. And that's the United Kingdom's position. Our Foreign Secretary articulated that very clearly a few hours ago in New York, when he welcomed the adoption of the resolution. This is a crisis, as he said. It is a grave crisis, and it is one that we are determined, along with the international community, to play our role in bringing an end to.
You mentioned a lasting peace in the Middle East. Of course, the conflict right now is between the Israelis and Hamas, yet the negotiations are ongoing between the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority and also the PLO. We always hear about the quartet, the UN, the US, the EU, and Russia. Two of those we hear about a lot in negotiations for a peace in the Middle East, the UN and the US. However, the EU and Russia, some people say, aren't pulling their own weight in the quartet. What more can the EU and also the UK unilaterally do to help promote a lasting peace in the Middle East?
I would disagree with that. I can't speak on behalf of Russia. I can speak on behalf of the United Kingdom, and as we are a member of the European Union, I think also the European Union. I would disagree that the European Union is not pulling its weight. I think if you look in terms of development assistance, the European Union in the Palestinian authorities is the largest single provider of development assistance. You see the role that is being played by France at the moment as the presidency of the Security Council, France and the Czech Republic working together, the talks that are currently going on in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt to try to get a parallel track in terms of some form of ceasefire in operation. So I think European leadership is there and is very strongly there. I think the United Kingdom, as I said in New York this a few hours ago, the Foreign Secretary was there leading the discussions with his French counterpart. This resolution drafted by the United Kingdom, I think we couldn't be more to the fore.
Do you think the United Kingdom also has a role to play in influencing the United States? People say that no lasting peace can be done unless the United States is fully behind it. The United Kingdom has the strongest relationship with the United States from the European point of view. Does the UK have a role in that area too?
I think we coordinated the evidence from New York in the last 3 days when Secretary of State Rice, David Miliband, the French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner, they're working together. I think there is a lasting relationship between the European position and the United States in relation to this. And the quartet is designed to show that the European Union, the United States, United Nations and Russia working together. And I think there's a good track record of doing that, and it's a two-way process.
Turning to another issue of the Pope's speech, One of the first things he mentioned was the Convention on Cluster Munitions, signed at the end of last year in Oslo, negotiated in large part in Ireland. This is a treaty banning what's commonly known as cluster bombs. When you look at the countries that did not sign this, you see the United States, you see Israel, you see Russia, you see India, you see Pakistan. You see countries who say, "Well, we have to fight. Therefore, we can't sign this." However, the United Kingdom is also a country with an active military. It did feel that it could sign this treaty. Why is that?
Well, I would say we didn't only sign it, but actually, you need to go back farther back and go to Wellington, which was the conference that preceded Dublin, and actually, it was a work between the Holy See and the United Kingdom that actually helped to move the process forward. We believe in this treaty. We believe in a process of disarmament. We didn't believe that these weapons are necessary components of an active military. That's a conclusion we took. We signed the treaty in Oslo in December, and we have actively worked on it to try to use our diplomatic network to try to spread the message, and we've done that in conjunction with the Holy See. And actually, we're very, very proud of our practical working relationship between our disarmament ambassador in Geneva and the Holy See delegation in Geneva. And as I said, both at Wellington and Dublin, those two delegations did their utmost to try and broaden the consensus as much as possible. But it's not just about cluster munitions. In some senses, somebody could say, if you wanted to be brutal, cluster munitions is in the bag. The next thing we have our eyes on is the arms trade treaty, and we will be looking to replicate the success that we've had on cluster munitions by working so closely with the Holy See by focusing on the arms trade treaty in 2009.
That was Britain's ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Campbell, talking to Charles Collins. Another envoy present at the meeting with the Pope was the ambassador to the Holy See from Ireland, Noel Fahy, who spoke to my colleague, Lydia O'Kane.
Now, you were saying that he touched on many different aspects. He touched on different countries, different themes. One of those themes I thought was quite interesting with regard to Ireland was the economic crisis.
Yes, I thought it was interesting that he made poverty and development a theme that runs right through the speech. It comes up in a number of areas. It comes up as a general topic. It comes up in the context of globalization, the threat to global prosperity. It comes up in the context of the situation in Africa. It comes up very powerfully at the end, I think, of the discourse where he refers to fraternal solidarity. And the speech was given in French, where the word solidarity has a particularly strong meaning of cooperation and mutual support and fraternal support. And yes, the economic theme is there very strongly. I certainly would accept that.
Yeah, because he talked about, just looking back to the speech here, and he was saying that bolstering the economy demands rebuilding confidence, and this goal will only be reached by implementing an ethics based on an innate dignity of the human person. How did you feel about his comments there?
I would say they're in common with a theme that he has adverted to many times in the past, and will probably again this year, because there's talk of an encyclical on social issues. I don't know when it'll come out, but it's certainly the kind of thinking that is in this discourse certainly points towards a very interesting encyclical on social policy when it comes, and one which will emphasise these themes. But there's no doubt that on many levels the question of poverty, solidarity, economic development, a fair and ethical economic development is a very strong theme in the speech, and one that we would certainly regard as important, and one that I've certainly picked up.
He also touched on secularism. Society which is secular in a healthy way does not ignore the spiritual dimensions and values. Looking at Ireland at the present time, how would you view the life of the church in Irish life at the present time?
Well, the church remains a very, very important institution in Ireland, and an institution that has a lot to say that is of significance and concern to the people of Ireland. All you've got to do is look at statements by the Irish bishops and statements by individual Irish bishops on, for instance, the current economic crisis. Ireland is certainly a country where the church is not behindhand in making its views known. It's interesting that the Holy Father places the idea of the church in a secular society in the context of his visit to France. Many of my colleagues noted that while there are references, specific references to particular continents in the Holy Father's speech, there's no specific reference to Europe. But when you actually look through the speech, you find a number of examples which drawn together show you that he still has a huge interest in Europe and in the countries in Europe. Your point about secularism is one of those aspects. Another aspect is his reference to the work of the European Union and bringing about peace in Georgia. But yes, it's interesting that again he continues the theme of the role of the church in a secular society, a theme that he developed very strongly when he was in France last year.
Looking again at the speech, I saw he talked about the cluster munitions.
Yes,
something that Ireland had a role to play in, with the conference being held in Dublin and signing on to that document along with the Holy See. So something again interesting from that point of view for Ireland.
Well, it was something that I noticed. It's very early on in the speech. It's literally in the first few minutes he refers to the Convention on Cluster Munitions. That was very important for us. Ireland played an important part in bringing the reality to the cluster munitions negotiations during negotiations at Dublin in midsummer, where the Holy See played a particularly important part in brokering an agreement. I think it was a very important achievement by a group of countries and by the Holy See last year. And it's an interesting example of a practical and significant role that the Holy See plays in international diplomacy.
Ireland's ambassador to the Holy See, Noel Fihi, speaking to Lydia O'Kane.
And now why don't we open the doors of the Sistine Chapel a moment with Monsignor Timothy Verdon, who'll be sharing with us a reflection on the artwork of Michelangelo in this very special place. Monsignor Verdon is a professor of sacred art at the Theological Faculty of Central Italy, based in Florence. Stay tuned. There's some beautiful images in the Sistine Chapel. Michelangelo really gave him his all to those frescoes, no?
Yes.
Is there anything you find particularly meaningful?
One fresco in the chapel that I consider to be a key to understanding the program, the theological program that Michelangelo was developing, is the figure positioned in the most conspicuous place, that is to say, the prophet positioned directly above the papal altar, the prophet that those entering the chapel, as Michelangelo expected us to enter, from the Sala Regia, that is to say, in procession from the Vatican Palace and not through the museum corridors, those entering through the main door and not the little back door through which today tourists enter, would have seen first. It's also the biggest and most dramatic of the prophet figures. It is the prophet Jonah. Jonah, seated directly above the papal altar, is turning dramatically on his seat to gaze right up into the first of the scenes in the center of the ceiling depicting creation. It is the scene of God separating light from darkness. Jonah, from where he sits, turns to look right up at this, and it's clear that he's absolutely amazed.
Bewildered.
Bewildered, practically shocked. And so the question is, what does this dramatic and even disturbing figure, this muscular, powerful, even morally powerful man who shows every sign of total disorientation as he gazes up at the Creator God, at the very beginning of creation, what does this mean? I've explained it this way, and I think that anyone who has even a slight acquaintance with the chapel will remember some of the things I'm saying. When you come in that principal door, you come in really at the end of the Genesis story. You come in under the scene of Noah and his sons offering sacrifice. Then there's the flood in which God punished sinners, really destroyed sinful humanity. Then you have Noah and his sons offering sacrifice in the third scene. The very first scene is the sin of one of Noah's sons. The whole Sistine Chapel ceiling is under the sign of sin. After the stories of Noah, the first of the stories of Adam and Eve is the sin of our first parents. Why is sin so important? Sin is important in the Sistine Chapel because the only real power the Pope has is the power of the keys, the power to give the world God's forgiveness. That's what the keys stand for. Pope Julius II, who commissioned the chapel, had been Papal Penitentiary, is the office today covered by the American Cardinal James Francis Stafford. Pope Julius II had had that same office under his uncle, Pope Sixtus IV. He knew about sin. He knew about the problems of sin and forgiveness. As Pope, he was in charge of distributing the forgiveness of Christ to the world. So sin is important. Jonah is put in that central position because Jonah, as a prophet, had been sent to the sinful pagan city of Nineveh to preach forgiveness. And he had not wanted to go because he said, God is too good. These people may repent and God will forgive them. And I don't think those pagans should be forgiven. So Jonah tries to escape. Everyone knows how from the belly of the whale he is brought back and he finally agrees to go to Nineveh. He begins to preach with a heavy heart, thinking they'll never repent, but they do, from the king down to the humblest citizen. They put on sackcloth and ashes. And when Jonah sees that God does not, therefore, destroy the city, he's very put out. And he goes outside of Nineveh and sits on a hillside and sulks. And it's very hot, the book of Jonah says, and he gets more and more angry. And when night comes, God plants a seed and lets a tree grow. And Michelangelo shows us the leaves of this tree in the background of the Jonah fresco. And so the next day, Jonah's a bit mollified because he has the shade of the tree. The following night, God sends a worm to destroy the root of the tree. And so the third morning, Jonah wakes up and his tree isn't there. And now he is absolutely fit to be tied. He's absolutely furious that he doesn't even have the tree to give him shade. And it's at that point that God intervenes and says, Jonah, do you have any right to be angry? Because a tree that you neither planted nor watered, and which grew up in a night and then perished in another night, is no more. If you have a right to be angry about that, how should I feel about losing this great city with all of its humans and its animals? And so Jonah understands that the God who created all things does not want to destroy them. That the just God who asks for repentance for sins asks for that repentance in order to save what he has created, not to destroy it. Jonah understands that he was wrong in wanting to see sinners punished, and that the God who created all human beings and even the animals wants only the salvation of his creatures. There you have an extraordinary example of a highly focused catechesis, if you like, directed at the Pope and his court, directed specifically at the people who would have used that chapel in the 16th century, who would have had little difficulty in grasping the sense of that message.
But Michelangelo was not a theologian. He had theologians to help him better understand the story of creation. Is that right?
That's certainly true. Michelangelo writings claims at one point that He was allowed to do what he wanted in the Sistine Chapel, and that's simply not credible because it was too central, too important, too official a place. Michelangelo could interpret the themes that were given him according to his artistic talent, but the themes were certainly spelled out for him. So here we're talking about a very rich and focused theological program that was given to Michelangelo, which he could understand because in his youth, he probably was very close to people who dealt with these subjects. His elder brother was a Dominican friar. He had heard Savonarola preach. One of his teachers was the canon of the Florence Cathedral, Marsilio Ficino, who was also a Neoplatonic philosopher. So Michelangelo had more than a smattering of this kind of information, but certainly the great lines of the program were laid out for him by court theologians of Julius.
And our thanks there go to Monsignor Timothy Verdon, Professor of Sacred Art at the Theological Faculty of Central Italy based in Florence, for sharing with us his expertise. Finally, time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Did the Romans believe in astrology? And is the word astrology of Latin derivation?
Well, actually, it's Greek, but astrum is a star, and so astrology is the science of the stars. That's all. It's Latin the way it's written now, but really, it would have like Greek derivations. It's older than Latin.
But did the Romans believe in the signs of the stars?
Yeah, certainly. The influence in them, and they didn't have the elaborate thing as we have today with our whole, you know, zodiac. But the old Greeks and stuff, they had the different people and the different famous people ended up in the sky or were taken up to the sky. Heaven's sakes, Ovid had his metamorphoses, where all these gods were taken up and put up in the sky, which turns out to be your zodiac.
I don't think
it was as strong as it is today, you know, with every other day you have to have your sky reading and all that nonsense.
A horoscope.
Yeah, horoscope, okay. But they follow, certainly they had, the gods were in the skies.
How would you say spaceship then?
Well, there you go. There's no problem there, but you say, you know, Australia will Siderium Navigium, Navigium, a ship, a starship.
An extraterrestrial?
Well, there's extraterrestrial. That's all Latin too, because extra terra means beyond the earth. So extraterrestrium, you say, I don't know, extraterrestris, you'd say. It's extraterrestris. The adjective would be terrestris in Latin. So you'd say those who are beyond the earth.
And astronaut?
There you go. There's your austro is your star, and nauta is a sailor on a ship. So one guy who sails around the stars is an astronaut. The whole thing's incredible. Another thing, now that we're talking about astronauts, you will never believe this. In Latin, we say mundane in the world is mundus, you see, which means clean. In Latin, mundus also means a lady's, like, toiletry, you know, a little box of stuff, perfume and, you know, lipstick and stuff, is a mundus. Now watch. The same thing happened in Greek, that to be cleaner, let's say this little box of toiletry was called cosmos, which is where you get cosmetics from. The whole thing is incredible. But this is all Latin and Greek. So anyway, in any case, astronaut is Latin. And when the Russians called it a cosmonaut, you see, well, then that's all Greek. That's Greek.
So because the cosmos have the Greek, and the Americans have the Latin.
But they're the same thing. They're really the same thing.
Heartfelt thanks once again to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
Laudator Jesus Christus.